Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
You're awake to find yourself in a dark room.
Hello, and welcome to Ask the Industry Podcast, episode 110. I'm comedian Simon Kane, and for those of you new to the show, this is the podcast where I interview the most influential people from the worlds of stand-up, comedy, radio, and today, video games? John Robertson is a comedian, writer, and video game creator. We talked about what it is like starting out in Australia and moving to the UK. We touched upon his early competition credits, including America's Got Talent, where he faked a seizure, which led to him meeting his future wife. His live-action video game, The Dark Room, started life as a YouTube video series, then became a sleeper hit at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, and now is a real-life game for sale on Steam. We talked about moving the idea from different mediums, developing his persona and his onstage style and comedy uniform, as well as continuing to develop other stand-up shows while touring essentially a video game around the country. I found it really fascinating. As I mentioned in the podcast, I saw The Dark Room for the first time this year at the Edinburgh Fringe, and I loved it. I found it fascinating, hilarious, infuriating, and all the things that I kind of didn't know I wanted until I saw it. I highly recommend it if it's in your area. It's amazingly interesting, and I'm going to be getting the game at some point, largely because I really want to finish it. And the show that I went to, every moron picked the same route, which meant we died every time. It's so annoying to be sat in a room with people that don't understand how video games work. If you haven't seen the game, or you haven't seen the show even, don't worry, you will understand what's going on. It's not like this is too much of a love letter to his cult fan base, although the game and the show is, and as a result, I've tried to capture as much of that on this show as possible for the people that will probably look it up and search for it because they like the show or the game or whatever it is that they're looking for on the internet late at night in their parents' basements. So, before hitting play, I am just going to ask you that if you're new here, please do remember to hit the subscribe button. If you're old here, please do remember to give us an honest, ideally positive review in iTunes. And either way, please do join the Facebook group. It's called Ask the Industry Podcast, and it's on Facebook, obviously. Before I hit play on the podcast, I just want to say that I have signed up for the Edinburgh Festival, and I am currently previewing a show around the country. I won't go on about where and when that's going to be right now, but if you want to take a look in the show notes and have a look and see where I'm going to be previewing and where I'm going to be at the Edinburgh Festival, that would be great. I'd really appreciate seeing some of your faces at these shows. It's always lovely to have the audience come down and say, hey, it's me, I'm the person who tweets you, or hi, I'm a regular listener and I love it. So if you could come down to a show, that'd be really appreciated, and or the Edinburgh Festival. And if you're not able to come down, if you could just pass on the message to a friend who's in the area, that would be massively, massively appreciated, and I can't thank you enough for the support. But for now, let's enter the dark room.
You said? I started in Perth.
Perth, sorry.
I have been to Melbourne, by the time this goes out, four times, and I've been a stand-up for 15 years. I started out in Perth, in Western Australia. By the time I got there, there were two rooms on the thrilling commercial evenings of Wednesday and Thursday. and you couldn't perform in the Thursday room unless you were doing well on the Wednesday room. And some people might think, oh, was the Wednesday room like an open mic room or like a feeder system? No, it was a full pro bill. And they would put open micers on at the end, and about four or five after the headliner. So you'd go on at about 10:30 at night, stretch out to 11 and perform to the maybe six or seven people who had stayed after the headliner. And if you were routinely doing well there, you could go to the Thursday show, which was just this really very creative, but it was also very commercial, you know, and good, right? And both rooms were good. Like the Wednesday room had a kind of knockabout charm because it was run by a collective of comedians, and the general sense was if you could accomplish 10 minutes, then you should at some point during the year get a go and get a paid gig. And a lot of people got to say they were comedians off the back of their charity, myself included.
It sounds like they've just stacked the deck against you, though.
No, not really.
Because they've put on all the good comedians and then put on the open mic.
You assume there were good comedians on.
Okay, there were
comedians who could talk for 20 minutes.
Okay.
I mean, not hanging shit, but when I first turned up in Perth, a lot of the guys who were headlining shows were blokes who you would look at now and you would go, that is 20 minutes of pretty solid material stretched out to 40 to 50 with no discernible response from the audience. Not everyone was like that. There were some blokes who were really shit hot. But by the time I showed up, the joint was, it was very top heavy with guys who were kind of, some of them were like hobbyists who had stuck on for a long time. And the guys who were like really careerists, you could smell that they were careerists. And so they were the guys who'd be like, oh, don't do that. Like, you want to be careful, because they were doing corporate gigs, you know, and that was their main source of income. But despite that, I mean, there were so many guys there who were just really into young guys coming through and being creative and being interesting. And also, for what I'm saying there, like, the variety of what was on was phenomenal, you know, because, like, you would have the worst horrors of, like, kind of, oh, I'm an Australian fucking shithead fucking comic fucking, anyway, so I'm going down the road and these black blokes are, you know, you had those guys. They didn't, they tended to go out and work in the desert and then return to the city and wonder why their material had magically stopped working. You know, kind of the moment, you know, they went to a place that actually had a postcode or electricity. That tended to be a thing. But then there were guys...
line.
Yeah. yeah, a power line that was connected to something, you know. you know, a landmark more than just sort of a lonely prostitute who'd kind of fallen out there many years ago, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah, and there were guys like, you know, guys who were, you know, had studied Commedia dell'arte. Like, I'm thinking of my mate Don, who, you know, had gone to Italy in the 70s and come back with a profound understanding of Italian clowning, but who could also bust out a guitar and do a Bob Dylan parody talking blues called What Are You Staring At, Cunt? Right? You know, so this is a guy who is, you know, look, but he was like a very, very good universal communicator, because he would clown for children and he could go down to a rough pub gig and do this. And without ever being a sort of cock-swinging, ultra-macho comic, he was just very good at manipulating low status into sympathy, right? And there were people like Novak and Good, who were a female musical duo who had a bit that mostly consisted of, they had built what I realize now was like, I thought it was a steak when I saw it. I thought it was meant to be like, because I was 17 when I started, so I had no real experience of anything.
And in 2002?
Yeah. And I was watching them. And yeah, they had this whole bit that just seemed to be the smaller one, Jude, hitting the other one just in the vagina, just with what appeared to be like a papier-mâché raw steak. And I only years later found out that it was a dog's penis, is what it was meant to be. I don't know what that bit was about.
No.
I just remember that it was visually interesting.
Was that the Chortle review? Because that's
well, no. I mean, the thing is, it was visually interesting. I was 17. I mean, I didn't take drugs, but I was just, you know, dopey all the fucking time, because pretty much the minute I got an erection, all the blood would go and I was unable to think, you know, and I would be so stressed because I was going to go on stage. So, you know, these things just occur in a haze of memories, you know. So it's like every single show blurred into one. Like Joel Bryant, who was 6'3" and ultra commanding and had this amazing ability to do sets and just to stretch out his arm and just take the entire front row with him, right? He was great. And I remember him. We did a show. It was Novak and Good, me, and I was, at the time, I was a Baptist minister character. There was a lot of, because a lot of the comedy came from the theatre, right? And so I had created a Baptist minister character called, to my enormous shame and regret, Father Clancy Auschwitz, because I was 17 and I did, I'm an edgy little fucker, look at me go. And it was meant to be a parody of right wingers, but the problem was, as with satire, I had a couple of blokes come up to me and go, I like that.
Yeah.
I think that's good. I think it's good what you're doing. And the character was pretty quickly retired around the time that happened, except for the huge Texan bloke who came up to me, because Father Clancy used to make it very clear where his actual leanings lay, because he would remember periodically that he was gay and start crying. You know, so you got to understand, like, the clubs that I'm talking about here, this Wednesday club, even though, because, like, you're talking about a huge variety of acts, to the point that here's a 17-year-old who's going to come on stage with what's actually a high-concept character.
Yeah.
And I would have, like, a wooden crucifix, which was huge and, you know, had been made for me by an ex-girlfriend, and it said, "To my John, my love forever," and that was burnt into the wood. And so people wouldn't fuck with me because I had a weapon. And I seemed to be crazy, you know. And it also helped that Perth at the time, whilst a very conservative place, if they got a whiff of genuine difference on the street, like I had to learn. I've spoken about this a bunch of times. I had to learn to be performatively tough and weird on the street so that people wouldn't, you know, kind of beat me up for perceived, you know, weakness. Mm. You know what I mean? Like as though the idea that I might bugger a boy might be a terrible thing. You know, it's a really racist, homophobic place. But in this joint, right, it was positioned such that Diana Starr, who ran it, was so kind and so giving, right, that they'd allow a deranged pubescent to get up on stage and be like, "I'll tell you something, and I got these opinions about racism, and I'm going to do this." And I used to finish on the very rare occasions when the act went well, I would finish with a thing called the Twin Towers song, which was a poem, which just went, "I'm a twin tower, tall and wide. I've got 50,000 people inside. When a plane hits me, I explode and scatter their corpses on the road," you know. Which is not in and of itself hysterical, but the actual punchline to that is going, "Everybody!" But then the people would do it, right? And, yeah, I did it one thing that people didn't, you know, because I never had any sense of who was actually in the crowd. And as it turns out, of a Wednesday night in the middle of Perth, in Northbridge, occasionally the American fleet comes to town. And I was doing it, and a large contingent of naval gentlemen was seen to not be enjoying the crowd singing along. And I did it because a man with a cowboy hat seemed to be agreeing with Father Clancy a bit much. So I was like, "Here we go, I'll twist the knife into you." And he came up to me at the end, he went, "You're going to be a big star the moment you knock off that 9/11 bullshit." He was wrong, but nevertheless, you know, like, because it didn't happen the second I knocked it off, and it hasn't happened yet, but we'll get there.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, you got to understand, this was a permissive, interesting joint,
right?
And it was perfectly suited because the amount of new talent coming in, like people who were going to stick with it, was pretty limited. You know, there must have been about five of us, you know, like coming through. Most of the guys are there were guys who had been there forever, or they were coming in from the eastern states, and they were quite comfortable, you know. And then as time went on, some blokes opened up a Friday night room, and then that became another place I couldn't get booked. Because also one thing that I should point out is that I couldn't, for all of my ferocity of invention and my ferociousness on stage, I couldn't emotionally cope if it didn't work. So a lot of shows degenerated into either me as me crying, like visibly crying on stage, or Father Clancy breaking character and crying. And then to overcompensate for 3 years, I became a pretty good commercial act. But if I heard a noise that wasn't anything to do with what I was doing, I would threaten the audience with extreme physical violence. And that was it. As a friend of mine said, they were like, "You were so good, but we just couldn't use you." Yeah. Like none of us could. Mm-hmm. But then a Tuesday night room opened, which was a genuinely inventive open mic room. And that just gave us all probably the necessary stage time to go back to the Wednesday show and do a good pro set. Because for all of what I'm saying about how, you know, encouraging that room was, the audience fucking wasn't. Mm. You know, my favourite thing on earth used to be to go down there on a Wednesday night and watch guys come in from the UK and just eat shit. Because the MCs used to come out and, you know, UK MCs love to go, "Hello, how are you? Where are you from?" Right? And in this room, that was not on. They hated crowd work, like that crowd. Like, you had to, if you wanted to start that show, you had to come out, do your best joke first, and the audience as one would go, "Funny, and we're going to give you 2 minutes." Yeah. Right? But yeah, so that could be, it was a hard fucking room. So I'd watch these guys go, "Hello, what's your name?" "Fuck off." "That's my name." Like, "Oh, well, okay, mate." Yeah, it was great. They had no, like, it was a room where whatever you were going to do, they would take it as long as you grabbed them by the throat and didn't let go.
Right.
But even then, they'd criticize you on your grip strength.
So you had to, I mean, this is like 17 to 20, your age. So you naturally had to quickly get a thick skin. And this was the time when you were doing competitions as well.
Well, that's how we started. I got entered into an open mic competition.
That's how you start in,
that's how
in Australia, you mean, or in person?
In Australia, in general. My friend Mel, who was a fantastic fan of comedy and a fantastic supporter of it, if not necessarily of every aspect of my career at the time, she entered me in an open mic competition. And I didn't have any sense of what stand-up was, because to me it was a magical thing that didn't bear analysis. And I thought that it was something that you improvised every night, completely differently, which anyone who had seen more than one stand-up gig would tell you is not true, unless that's exactly what you want to do, which is, of course, what I do now and have been doing for the last 6 years of the 15 years, you know. Which, you know, because I started traveling internationally and I realized that my whimsical wordplay observations about Australia were not perhaps hitting it in Cambodia, and yet at the same time they were responding again to my energy and my presence and my voice. And of course, when you take all of that together and you just start attacking people in the crowd, everybody understands they're being called stupid. It doesn't matter what language it is. Yeah. People love that.
Yeah.
You know, and that was also thanks to Don, because he doesn't like that I do that. He really doesn't like it. But because I've taken what I learned from him about clowning and I use it to make stories and we go on little journeys, right, he appreciates it now, because he used to think it was just an expression of my sadism. But now he understands that it is both an expression of my sadism and masochism.
Yeah. So. It's a chosen thing rather than a sort of defense mechanism that,
yes,
could be misinterpreted as.
Well, exactly. Well, the thing is, that's what it initially was.
Yeah.
But I like when you said, you have to quite quickly get a thick skin. I was like, oh, no, that took 5 years.
Mm.
That, I mean, I was like genuinely a liability.
I think I saw
on stage
on
for 5 years.
I think I saw on your website you said something like, I started making money from it in like 4 years and or something like that, and then I didn't get good till the 10th or something.
Well, yeah, that was it. The guys down at the Laugh Resort, which was the Wednesday room, I mean, they started paying me probably after about a year, which is very nice, or maybe even shorter. You know, and they were really good, because, you know, they understood that I was a guy. I'm very commission oriented. You know, it's a throwback from school, right? Do this assignment, it's due here. Like, oh, I'll do it. But if I'm left to my own devices, you know, I'm like, well, I could tie someone up and put them in a cupboard, consensually. They like that. You know what I mean? I'm much more inclined to recreation than I am to like, oh, wouldn't it be fun to just nut out this creative thing? Like, yeah, it would be if there was a dollar sign attached to the end of it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm really good at that. You know, dangle some money and I'll fucking show up.
Yeah.
You know, I've never lost that really mercenary edge. I mean, they started paying me. And yeah, with the open mic competition, I mean, that was my bloody windmill. I was Don Quixote, and that was my windmill for years. This competition called Roar, I made it to the state final twice. I was so like, and so bloody stressed. This is in 2007, the last time I did it, which fans of Raw Comedy will let you know that you're not actually allowed to enter that thing more than three times. So if I'd been going since 2003 and entering every year, what the fuck, you know? But I remember being so mortally terrified that the first thing I did was I went into the communal toilet that we were all using at the back of this very large, lovely theatre called the Regal Theatre, where Barry Humphries used to perform in Perth before the kid made it. And like the toilet was overflowing just from everyone just going in and just, you know, having a piss. So I just urinated just all over the floor in this kind of very angry, neurotic, you know, and drunk as well. Like I would have had such vodka before going on, you know, just in this marking of territory, which, you know, to be honest, if I owned anything that night, I probably owned the toilet. You know, because I went out and I was so stressed that I peeled my entire little fingernail off about 10 seconds before my name was called. So I walked on stage with my hand in my pocket ultra casually, but while my pocket was slowly filling with blood. And I delivered what in 2007 was my set, which was 5 okay one-liners.
Why... If you knew you weren't, or did you know then that you that was not good, or that you, because now you're saying, yeah, I wasn't good. So I'm wondering whether it was a case of,
yeah,
you have to enter the competition, like we'd say you think you're funny, by a certain point in your career, so you were going at it early, or if it was a case of ego, or
it was entirely to
get out of what you were in, the situation, if you could get, you know.
Win. Yeah, it was a combination of ego and the desire to get out, because that was the only way. Right, was to go, you know, go do a big gig and show them that you could do it really well. And, you know, as a result, like, it helped, you know, in the end. But, you know, I never had any plans for what I was going to do with it. And, like, if I look back over my career now, I mean, there's a period in about 2012 where I am, like, to be honest, I am a really good, and I still am, I'm a really good big theatre mainstream jacket comedian. If I want to be, you know, I know how to work. I mean, I could be I could genuinely be an evangelist. I could run a mega church, right? If I could sing better, I could genuinely be a rock star. And this is, you know, like we control audiences when we do dark room, and we do it as me as well. But like, I've seen footage of me telling a story to 3,000 people, right? And I recognize all the tropes in there where I'm like, hang on a minute. That bit went really well, so look at my walk of triumph along the stage, you know. Oh, I'm taking my time. These movements are unnecessarily big, but also very slow, so everyone can take them in, you know. And I recognize that, and I'm like, wow, that's not really what people know me for at all. You know, like even people at the time, but I was like, wow, okay. Somewhere between 2008 and 2012, I learned some shit. But, you know, it kind of helped that in 2008 I actually won one of these fucking open mic competitions.
Yeah.
You know, and then that meant that I started getting booked on the East Coast in Sydney and Melbourne and Brisbane. And, you know, like the whole thing was, to be honest, like totally driven by ego. And also the fact that in 2008 I got fired from my day job. So I immediately had to turn pro or else we couldn't eat. You know what I mean? So it was like, shit, no, got fired, fucking gotta do it, gotta do this, gotta win, gotta go to Sydney, gotta do this, gotta do as many gigs as possible, gotta do this. And yeah, and so for a while, like, even though what I'm saying to you there about the arena comedian, I was also at that time, like, the guy, I did a lot of rugby clubs, you know, I was also very overweight, so I was able to show up and had short hair, so I was able to show up to a lot of places and be exactly that comedian that I hated.
Right.
You know, hey guys, how are you? Oh, you know, where are you, you wanker? Oh, you know, such observance, such tremendous.
So was you putting on a character for that?
No, I didn't feel like it was a character. Oh, okay. I mean, I was profoundly driven. I was also at the time, because I had, I'd had a very physically active job, right? I was a kid's puppeteer.
Okay.
At a science centre, which meant doing about 4 or 5 shows a day. And I made that as high octane slapstick comedy as I could. And then I would insist on carrying everything. Like, and we're like, we worked at a science museum, so you're carrying parts of a Tesla coil and all this and all this heavy shit. And like, I was getting quite fit. But when I left that job, right, because my brain in moments of stress just gets rid of facts, you know. Like, I used to have a gym across the road from my house, and I had a membership at the gym, and I could have gone there any time, and I didn't. What I did was I bought a whole fuckload of weight loss pills and drank them with energy drinks and Coke Zero. And so I was incredibly, you know, looking back on it, I was incredibly high and angry all the time and incredibly driven, right, but only towards things I understood. And what I understood was showing up and getting the money and doing the thing, you know, so hyper-aggressive. And I was very good at that. And that worked for a while, you know, but I went to a rugby club once and I got asked, and I tell comics this, and they sort of go, oh, lucky day. You know, like, I show up, and I meant to be doing the middle spot, and I've just come on. I've come on after my mate Alex, who used to impersonate the then Prime Minister of the day. So he's come, oh, hello, everyone. I'm former Australian Prime Minister John Howard. I'm a profound racist. And that would have gotten a round of applause, not because he was a profound racist, but because they probably agreed with, you know, Howard's policies. And so he'd been on, and then it was going to be me, and I had just bought a Scully coat, which is this, Rich Hall wears them. They're black cowboy coat with nice embroidery on it. Mm. And I came out, but before I went on, they went, oh, John, the headliner's running a bit late, so can you do a bit extra? And I went, how long? And they went, oh, I don't know, about 20? And I went, you got $500? And they went, yeah? And they just got it for me. They just gave it to me. You know, they just got it. I watched them get it out from the till. They went, there you go. It's like, righto. You know, so I fucking doubled my fee, you know. So I went out and I was doing what I thought was a really perfunctory roughhouse pub show. And when it was over, I ran into the headliner, who was a bloke with an acoustic guitar, who would get up in a minute and reveal that he hadn't updated his act since Green Day had released Time of Your Life. So 1997 or 99, oh, you know, give him his credit, 99, even though his intro to it was, this is a song by Green Day, whatever a Green Day is, right? And he came up to me and he didn't indicate I'd done a good job, but he went, oh, hello, I'm here. And he had the same jacket. At that point, I was like, I gotta do something.
Yeah.
I'm seeing the future, and I don't like it. And the other thing was, it was interesting, what I thought was my future did not like me either, because it turned out he'd bitched to me while I was on stage. He went, oh, I don't like these new school comedians. Mm. So I don't know. I must have been doing something different to what I thought I was doing, but I'm pretty sure I wasn't.
I've had to stall for headliners before, and I've had to fill time for people who are turning up. Personally, I've never done what you just said you did, and I've never heard anyone do that before. And it sounds like it's very much you had an air of confidence about being able to ask for that as well.
Mm.
Or was it a case of you just going, well, you know what, this extra work now? Or
well, yeah.
It, yeah.
Like, literally, I...
Did it stop you getting gigs? Did anyone go, well, he's going to, you know...
No, it didn't stop me getting gigs, because there was a culture of being paid for your work. And that was the most important thing, was that you be paid for your work. And this was a corporate function, and you get paid for your work.
Mm.
The whole, like, when YouTube started coming out, you know, and people started giving a lot of stuff away for free, right? I mean, you and I have had a chat about this, you know, at the Loft Bar, right, I recall, you know, and now that we've had less vodkas, you know, I think we can probably be a little more articulate about it. But to me, people giving anything away for free was completely anathema to me, you know, but that was because I was in a culture where I could get people to pay for me immediately. And I didn't really like the best I would do is I thought of myself like a plumber, which is, all right, you know, like, but I'd be like, yeah, okay, I want to establish a good working relationship with you. Like, yeah, I've got this weird, like, it's this weird faux masculine plumber butcher idea of, all right, mate, Yeah, I'll cut you a deal this time, but next time, you're right, price go up, yeah. Right? Which is actually not a bad way of working with people. But it did also mean that occasionally I would turn around, like, to rooms, you know, rooms who would be like, oh, hey, you know, come and do a couple of open spots for us, and then we'll think about booking you. And I'd be a bit like, nah. And that cost me bookings. Yeah, but also at the same time, you know, like there's at least one club, which was this, I mean, you know, the Sydney Comedy Store, who they went, oh, okay, come do two open spots. And I was like, well, it's the Comedy Store, so all right. And, you know, bless their heart, that was a Wednesday and a Thursday. So it was one night after the other. And it turned out the Thursday night show was a competition show, right? And I won a spot on the main show. So then I got up on the main show and I ended up in the bloody paper the next day. So like, great. So then they started booking me, right? But that was like, I should have taken the lesson from that, which was be confident and be polite and occasionally jump through the hoop, right? Whereas, you know, and it is, you know, it is appropriate sometimes to go in with front, right? But not always. And but as time's gone on, one thing I've realized is if I feel like I'm being undervalued, right? The thing I've learned is I'm not wrong when I feel that way now. I was then. Like at the time, somebody could say, oh, let's give you this. And I'd be like, how dare you insult my family? I'm paying a mortgage, you know, and all this. And I was constantly on about my fucking mortgage because we owned a house in Perth. I was like, my wife was mostly paying for the mortgage. Like, you know, so much of my attitude at the time was making up for the fact that I was a very small drop in the ocean in my own house, you know, let alone the world, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But one thing I found is like over here, there are guys who, you know, like I'll have a chat to and I'm like, oh, okay. It's like, for whatever reason, I'm not getting the sense that you see anything special in what I provide, or you just generally, like, you don't it's not like you don't respect me, but it's like, okay, something hasn't hit here, and you're thinking this is just somebody else, and I won't truck with that. I'm just sort of like, well, you know, and I'm just quietly like, okay, no more emails for them. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't need to go to that venue. I've got other things. I'm going to do this and this. You know what I mean? Or occasionally, as I like to say, we'll just hire the venue. You know?
Yeah. With what I find really interesting about that is the initial dark room was online for free, wasn't it? It was the YouTube version.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you get to the stage where you were like, actually, I'll give this all, not give this away for free, but I'll put it somewhere where it can be for free then to start with.
Well, I mean, okay, well, now we talk about darkroom. The weird thing is for all of
seamless,
it...
Right?
Seamless. Well, to be honest, for me, I feel like you've entered some HTML code because I'm like, darkroom, tags, you know, hello. Suddenly I'm there.
I'm very much an old school gamer.
So, oh, yeah,
and
I see.
I haven't been able... I honestly, because of the clashes with the thing, I got to see the darkroom for the first time this year and I loved it. And okay, it was because I'm more Mario than you know, sort of anything that they bring out, or Left 4 Dead's the only 3D game I've enjoyed in the last couple of years.
And really, just, Left 4 Dead,
yeah,
cool.
Well, it's just because it's literally just you, four friends, and a load of zombies.
Yeah, that is,
it doesn't
cool
have to be, you yeah know what I mean, there's no big game plan.
You should get yourself Fist of the North Star, Lost Paradise. That's
the same thing.
Oh no, but it's just the best dumb fun I've had in ages. Oh,
okay.
It's so good and it never overcomplicates itself. It's,
yeah, that's just the thing. I feel like too many games, Yahtzee Croshot does a lot of this.
Oh yeah, he does.
He's
yeah
constantly banging on about, oh, the plot point needs to be, and I'm like, it doesn't always have to have a plot. Could just be as simple as we're playing a game.
Yeah, it could be anything.
Yeah, you
know? Well, think of it like there's a game called Kung Fu Master. In Kung Fu Master, the evil Kung Fu Master X has stolen your girlfriend.
His name for just X.
Yeah, X.
Just X.
Has stolen your girlfriend. And if you'd be so good as to go to his house and walk from left to right, punching very much the same man, armies of the same guy, for the next 20 minutes, you might get her back. Right? It's called Kung Fu Master. You can punch and you can kick. That's it. It's still good.
Is there an option of just going to meet another girl that
no
isn't going to get
no of course there's no option?
That's a shame.
It's not, you know, it's not called Kung Fu Coward. Look, this is something I can't broach. People who want extra backstory in video games, that
there's none in the dark room.
No, well, there is actually.
Is there?
Oh, there's a fuck ton.
Oh, I haven't got the game yet, so I'm sorry.
Oh, there you go.
That's why.
No
although
worries.
I did watch a video 2 days ago for this of someone doing the game. Mm. Like, as in, you know, like those live streamers.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, so, good. Oh, yeah. Thank you for that. Yeah, thanks for watching. Look, the thing with giving Darkroom away for free, like right at the start
the
on YouTube.
One.
Yeah, I mean, but that was a different time. That was when I was, like, in my mind, like, really being paid quite significant money to perform as a live act. And I was doing stuff like in Perth, which even though it wasn't like friends of mine got jobs on FM radio, various other friends got their own TV shows, things like that. I was doing things like I was the opening act for Wayne Brady. I was the opening act for Steve-O. I was doing these things that meant that for a and I had my anime conventions, which were huge, like colossal stuff. And that was the best part of my career. So like Darkroom was originally a joke I told at the anime convention Wycon, who paid me very handsomely to be there. So because, and the thing was, I would have like forgotten about, you know, oh, giving stuff away for free or whatever my ethos was at the time. Because I was so boosted by the swell of enthusiasm from those guys. Because I was always treated so well. Like, they were like my family. It was like the first gig I would do every year is I would go down to Wycon and I would host the cosplay and maybe do a Saturday night entertainment, maybe go do a stand-up show or something in this beautiful 3,000-seat theatre, which is where, you know, like Tenacious D played there. I mean, you know, it was, they didn't open for me, but you know what I mean? Like, it's great, you know. And I mean, so because the response to, because I just did this bit about how crap old video games were, and because that bit stretched to 40 minutes because of the audience interaction, right? I mean, it was, you know, we've got to do something. And then I was like, well, hold on a minute, YouTube annotations, I could put options. Oh, Christ. So off we went, you know, and like, that's why we gave it away for free, because it was just meant to be something. And then it was a then what happened was, because it went viral, right, suddenly I was, you know, that was just a thrill.
What do you, sorry, I don't interrupt you, but what do you call viral? Because obviously the number of views has changed for how much viral means.
Well, yeah, well, at the time, okay, well, look, we got in a very short space of time 4 million channel views off the back of Darkroom, right?
Do you know how that? Did you have a load of subscribers at the time?
Or no, okay. Not at all. Still don't. You know, I had a very talented YouTuber, Max Mofa, who at the time, I mean, he's on his millions now, but he at the time, I watched his work. He had a video that was just him zooming in on the anus of a cow, right? And I was like, what? You know, it was hysterically funny though. Oh, and yeah, that was the video where he was flipping off animals as well. Like that, and I thought that was really fun. Mm-hmm. And as the camera just kept getting closer and closer to this cow's anus, I was like, ah! You know, the thing was, I was like, if this were in black and white and slower, I'd think this was transgressive French art. So yeah. I was into it. And you know, and we all were, because the camera was forced right up there. But he wrote to me at the time because he was like, how have you done this? Because you don't have any subscribers, like, because it hadn't ever occurred to me that YouTube would be anything that I'd want to do. And even I said to him at the time, I was like, well, it's not my focus, you know, because it isn't. My focus at the time was just performing live, because I find that to be a really romantic thing to do. Stupidly, I could have, you know, spent the, oh, I don't know, the 23 and a half hours a day that I'm not performing stand-up. I probably could have used some of that to release some more videos. But the thing that we've done, like that channel now, and I'll get back to your question in a second, is because I put long form stuff on there and short form stuff, we've made a place that people just spend days hanging out on my channel, you know, and they just sit there and they just eat all this content. And it's kind of nice. But like, there's been an inflation as to how much content's required. You know what I mean? Yeah. So it's like at the moment, I have a look and I'm like, in the last month, I get something. And like, I'm not pulling this out of my ass, but it's things like, you have provided 4 million minutes of viewing content. People have watched 4 million minutes of your stuff. And you have earned $4.95.
Yeah.
Right? But for me, that kind of says it all. Okay. In 2012... we put the thing out for free. It went viral. And I knew it was viral because suddenly I was on television in America. You know, I had to go and film extra content in a cupboard in Singapore while on tour in Singapore just to get level two going and all of this. I was on NPR. Various celebs played it. You know, on and on it went. The guy who made Monkey Island found it and tweeted about it. You know, all this stuff. And then the weird thing was, because we couldn't really monetize it because the videos were so short and having ads pop up, which was the only real way of doing it other than the pre-roll ads, at the time would have destroyed it.
Yeah, your pre-orders would be longer than the video.
Exactly. And you couldn't serve them if the video was longer than a minute. Mm. By the time we did monetize it, which got a great deal of hatred from players, you know, the sweller was already gone. So, you know, I think in the end, directly, the YouTube revenue off that was probably about $50. Mm. Whereas I was commissioned for more stuff off the back of it. Like I got some, like I ended up making a follow-up called The White Room for Hattrick Productions. And that was so successful that I had it erased from the internet. It does not exist and there are no traces of it anywhere.
Why did you have it?
It was a failed experiment.
If it did really well, surely you'd want...
Well, The Dark Room did really well. The White Room didn't.
Oh, sorry, I misunderstood.
Okay. No. What happened with The White Room is this, you know, very good production company. You know, they'd made Father Ted, you know. They went, look, we like The Dark Room. Can you make us one of our own? And because I didn't have any ideas at the time, having, you know, recently had one idea. I mean, and I say that, but I was always a very productive writer. You know, like I by that point, that's 2012, by that point I'd written 5 solo shows. Mm. And it's not like a mad person being like, I've written 30 novels, and then you see it and, you know, it's all spider scrawl and there are not real words. You know, these were good, cohesive, good shows that I'd written, you know, like, and different hours of stand-up and theatre shows, and I'd written a play and all this stuff. But because I didn't have an idea on the go at the time, I just inverted the previous idea I'd had. So I went, well, we had Dark Room, which is a parody of 1980s text adventures. Why don't we call it The White Room? And it'll be a parody of open world adventures. And instead of having 4 options, the options would be just about limitless. And instead of the character being British, he'll be American. And they went, sure. And they gave me a shooting budget. And because I had no sense of time management, I bought a green screen, some equipment. I set it up out the back of my house. I started doing some stuff there, which was good. To make deadline, I took all of my equipment to the Melbourne Comedy Festival, and every single day before I went to do my shows, I removed all the furniture from the furnished flat I was staying in, scratched up the floors, I was told later, to my mounting horror. never have I used the phrase, it was like that when I got here, so often. Yeah, I just had this studio and I would fall asleep under the studio lights and all this. And I just worked so hard to make this thing function. And we put it together and it was there for deadline. And then they went, great, we're going to release it in August. And this was in March. And I was like, fuck. Because I was like, I could have, you know. And then it was one of those moments where, like, if you're going to innovate, you can't, don't innovate just once. You know what I mean? Like with Darkroom, I innovated because I was doing something almost nobody was doing. And I'd also accidentally created a beautiful format that's really understandable. In this case, mobile had taken over being the dominant way that people watch YouTube in the intervening months between March and August 2013. So having a game based entirely on annotations which aren't clickable on mobile was not going to work. And by the time they released it, we also discovered that the guys running their channel had deleted about 30 of the videos because they were cluttering up their feed, right? So I had to put them in and redo it. And yeah, in the end, it just didn't work. And it gave... the other thing was because Dark Room was so much bang, bang, punchline, you know, you're in a dark room. How would you do that? You're an idiot. With The White Room, what we would do instead is The White Room was just very interested in everything you had to say. And I was a character called the Man Without a Moustache, who was just a bloke with a top hat and a moustache made of gaffer tape and this rotating column of eyes behind me that we'd animated very badly. And he would just sort of be, how are you? Why don't we go do this? And because there was no punchline at all, the tension just kept building and building and building. And some longtime fans wrote to me and just went, I've had an anxiety attack just trying to get through the first few videos. I got a tap out. And so, yeah, I waited about 3 months, realized it wasn't going to get any better, and just went, get rid of it. Mm. And they did.
So it's So you still had control over the final product?
Well, I spoke to the guys. I mean, the thing is, by that point, they were winding down their YouTube channel anyway.
Right.
So it didn't matter to them.
Yeah.
You know, they were happy with it. It was a valid artistic experiment.
Yeah. It feels a lot more forced than the darkroom was.
Well, the thing is, you say that, but you didn't see it. You know,
no, I'm saying it based on your description. I've not seen it.
No, I know. Yeah. I know that. But, I mean, the thing is, it was... Look, some things are created instinctively and it doesn't hurt. Some things are created under great duress, but the end result might be the same. And, yeah, White Room, if you looked at it, right, you wouldn't go, oh, Jesus, here's a guy busting his ass trying to make something. You would go, oh, yeah, this is a lunatic who's amusing himself. You know, that's what the end result was. That's it. Like, people, it's one of those things, one of the nice things about a live show, for instance, is people can see sweat.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, when it's done and when you're exhausted and you go in for, like, a really deep bow and there's that chance that you might not be getting back up from having bent down like that, people see that and they understand. Whereas when a project arrives, right, people don't see all the work that went into it. So the thing that arrived easily and the thing that arrived, you know, like the thing that was the agonizing childbirth and the baby came out sideways and malformed and you don't love it, kill it, right? You might not know.
Yeah,
I don't know the difference.
So, but it sounds like, so the deadline was March and it came out in August.
Yeah.
And you were in Edinburgh in August.
I was when it released.
So you were doing the Dark Room when they released the White Room.
I was.
And they knew that was going
to
be...
Yeah, yeah. They wanted it. They gave me a standee to put out the front of my show.
Okay. So did it lead to people to go and try the White Room then?
Not even remotely. The thing arrived 2 weeks into the Fringe.
Right.
By which point, you know, if you want a video, I don't know if this is still the case, but if you want a video to go viral, right, you know, like it can eventually, it can sit there for years and someone can find it and whatever the repackaging is. But if you really want to deliberately make it happen, you know, you got to get as many eyes on that as possible in the first fucking 24 hours. And by the time this came around, it just wasn't going to happen. And, you know, the thing is, I'm not disappointed about it. I don't think anyone involved in the end was disappointed. They just went, yeah, cool. Everybody took a chance. We made something that was creatively interesting. You know, these things happen. That's all. So what was the question?
No edit point at all. The question was, how hard was it to transfer the game from a YouTube format to live?
Okay.
How many previews did you do as well?
None. I didn't start doing previews. Okay, bearing in mind, the first time I wrote a solo show was 2008. I didn't start doing previews for my shows until 2015.
Right.
Oh, no, wait, 2014. But that's a tragic story, that one. Yeah, not professionally tragic, but personally. Because... Okay, and look, everything in this answer ties into what you've asked about Darkroom. I do not, if I can avoid it, I do not, or at least I didn't used to draft, right? I did not like to draft. I liked to, when I was younger, I would write something, assume that it was a perfect document, completely misunderstand my own actual skills, and go out and, you know, try to entertain people with some subpar Spike Milligan, Monty Python nonsense, which, of course, failed horrifically. And but how did it fail? I said it perfectly. I said it word perfect, right? Without realizing there was no space for humanity in that. I was a very confused young man because I also believed that everything should be done in a burst, right? And one thing that I've discovered, though, is if you do think that everything should be done in a burst, and you do everything in a burst for a really long time, you become really good at getting a lot of stuff done really quickly at a higher standard than people expect. You know, so it's that thing of it's like, oh, you know, like I've just written a book, you know.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Can't really talk about it other than the general concept, but it's coming out, right? And I mean, they were delighted because in 3 months it was there and they're like, holy shit. And of course, then we spent the next 6 months editing it. But you know what I mean? They're like, whoa, okay. You know, like it's that kind of like, oh, you want a production machine? I'll show you something. Yeah, that's great. You know, it's this kind of beatnik Spike Milligan thing of first idea, best idea. I can do this. So, you know, it's a combination of like, you know, being a workhorse and being good at just listening to your instincts and being impulsive, mm-hmm. right? Or what I used to refer to as genius when I was a lot younger and really thought that meant, because I thought a genius was someone who did things effortlessly. When, of course, a genius is somebody who does things well and is called a genius by people who didn't see the work that went into it. And sometimes claims to have done it effortlessly. It didn't occur to me that the beatniks were lying a lot of the time. I was, who knew? Who knew that these jazz drug addicts were going to lie to me? Anyway, you know, who knew William Burroughs was untrustworthy? You know, he only shot his wife. Who knew he was a fuckwit? Anywho, so with Darkroom, to turn it into a live show, that was my mate John Hayward. Was playing the game, and he went, you know, you could do it live. I went, what do you mean? He goes, well, you'd be the guy, and I just make a program where four options appear on the screen, and we'll make a thing where you can write the stuff down and it goes into a map. You could do that. And I went, all right. And we booked a show at the Fringe. We did it free because we didn't necessarily know if it was going to go anywhere, and the thing is we didn't think about it. You know, I must have spent maybe an afternoon making up that map, and then we got the program downloaded to my computer, having tethered my mobile to the computer while standing out the front of the venue, maybe half an hour before I went on. And the first show that Darkroom did, we did it to four blokes who sat in the front row, and by the time it was done, because I mean with four guys, it could at the time it ran for 20 minutes, I turned to my wife Jo and I was just like, shit, that's got legs, and it did. And the oddest thing about it is that year I was doing a hyper-scripted show that I absolutely believed was unparalleled critic bait. And it died on its ass because somehow in the years I'd been doing stand-up, right, I had almost entirely missed the fact that live is what really makes it beautiful, you know. And I couldn't get my writing and my performance side together. I could, like, if we were going to go do a big gig, I could pull out a crowd-pleasing thing that would make a lot of people really happy, right? But not like now, where I could show up with nothing and do that, right?
Yeah.
You know? And, yeah, so Darkroom at that point, right, I was like, it was an afterthought.
Yeah.
And, but it fucking took off again, you know, and so it was that thing of like, no, this is what has to happen. And that's where I poured the discipline. And yeah, it also helps that because I like to do things in bursts, right? When I see people who are doing the kind of, oh yeah, it's, you know, like it's Monday night and I'm going to go and do this and I'm doing these mics, man. And they're doing all this stuff. And, you know, like I've seen people who are more career-minded than they are creatively-minded without, you know, Kevin Costner was right. If you build it, they will come. Right, so when you've got the people who are there, like I once heard a guy who's talking to Phil Kay. This is on tour in the Philippines, and they're both lying on a beach. And he turns to Phil and goes, "I don't know, man. I'm in LA, and I think my ideas are more like a 10-year comics, and I'm only a 5-year comic. What do you know about that?" And you know, Phil Kay's sitting there, you know, he's drunk off his ass. He's, you know, hasn't changed his clothes in 4 weeks. You know, he's playing that guitar that's only got 3 strings. And for all of that, he's absolutely tremendous. He's like, I don't know. Yeah. I have no idea. You know, what are you talking about? And that was the thing as well. Like, I was like, hang on. You're more focused on your hypothetical career than you are on actually having a career, because your career is the work. You know, it's the work and what you can do to back up that work. So it's like, for me, I've occasionally been the guy who's like, look at me, I've got this product. Now I've got this product, and this product's deeply useful for you. And I, through force and charm and whatever, we're going to both agree, you know what I mean? Yeah. We're going to do this, okay? And then as the years have gone on and I've kind of chilled out a bit because I feel more secure in myself, right? It's like, oh yeah, this is my body of work. You guys like that? All right, take it or leave it. You know, not a bad thing, but it's like, okay, that's fine. We don't have to do anything. We can go do this here. We do this here. You know, I go where the love is.
Yeah. And what I was trying to get at with that.
What a horribly wanky thing to say, but at the same time, accurate. Yeah.
I feel like being authentic comes off wankery sometimes. Do you know what I mean? Like,
How did you make that worse?
No, do you know that?
Christ! Oh, God. Oh, I see. Sorry. Oh, you mean, but it's true though. Being authentic does come off.
Yeah.
Does come off as wankery, like using the phrase authentic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. All right. Hello. Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm going to ask you a horrible question. No.
Oh, give it a shot.
Well, no, it's not worth it. I know it's not. I'm not going to get past it. I've seen photos of you when you first started doing darkroom, like press shots and things, and I've seen the evolution of, let's say, your comedy uniform for the darkroom and off stage becoming a part of you, it feels, but also part of the character of you on the stage. And I'm wondering how that evolved and how you came to it.
Well, when I started doing stand-up, look, make no mistake, dear listener, every answer I've got is long-winded today, because I did someone else's live podcast earlier today, and I showed up late and I'd missed it and I was just shit. So I'm trying to make up for it with actual content.
We are getting thrown out of the room in 10 minutes.
I understand. That's fine. That's okay. Let them fucking try. Netflix will wait for me. Okay. And they have to at the moment because they haven't come knocking. Anyway, look, when I started, I had a sense of what I looked like on stage because I had a trench coat and I thought that made me look dangerous. And then as I got a bit older and my hair got long and I didn't brush it very much, I wasn't aware that I now looked homeless and dangerous in the worst possible way. Then I cut my hair and I suddenly looked sharp and I was very, very thin and I was very well dressed. And I had a sense that meant something, but I didn't really know. You know what I mean? Like, for a little while, I was very well presented. Then I lost my job and became this kind of hard-hitting, you know, I'm just going to be this. And then I literally became that guy, you know, and it just became, I was of the jeans and shirt brigade and the spiked hair. And I had, like, my only uniform was I had sideburns because that was really useful for an opening joke. Ugh. But then, and that filtered into darkroom as well. Like, if you look at early photos of darkroom is a bloke with a torch and a shirt. And then it became a shirt and a corset. And then that had leather trousers and big boots added to it. And eventually we added the shoulder pads and the hair. And then he became a fully formed guy. But for the entire time there, I had no... My old sense of presentation just vanished for a few years. I just had no idea what I looked like doing anything. And now when I see it, I'm like, okay, all right, that's a full package. And what... I don't know what level of, like, ego and ignorance that is, but it's that thing of just going, oh, I did it, so it must be okay.
It feels, in my head, you know, when you're picking your Sims character, I imagined you doing that. I imagined you sort of, maybe not the Sims, like, as in that game, but as in you designing it.
Yeah.
Because it feels so designed, but I imagine there was an organic process.
Well, the whole thing was organic.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's been the beauty of Darkroom.
Mm.
And to be honest, that became everything that I was looking for. Like, when I talk about working in bursts, right? Mm. The nice thing about it is it's organic, you know, and also, like, for instance, if you're writing, you know, it doesn't have to be a narrative, but just writing something that has to follow something. Okay. So you might get a really, you know, what feels like a really shit hot idea and it just pours out of you. And after a particular amount of time and experience, you can go, okay, even if that's not brilliant, because you can't assess that, you might just really like it. Okay. You can go, I know how to do that in a way that's appropriate for me. And I reckon, and this is in terms of live, but even just written, you know, and I think we can get this over. But then you might find, okay, this is the bit that really spurred this on and is like the beginning of the project.
Mm.
Now I need to match that with everything else. And that doesn't have to be hard. You just have to find the thing that does that,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's what I like to do. And I do that with all of my writing. And with live shows, right, it is just in the end informed by what's happening. And as the years have gone on, it's just like, okay, like somebody said to me at one point, oh, you should really wear a suit, right? And I thought about it and I was like, yeah, I should wear a suit. You know, and the reason my hair's bleached is because Abigailah Shimon came around the house and she just got her hair bleached. And I went, gee, that looks good. And my hair was a lot longer than hers, so I knew we weren't going to look the same. So I was like, great, I'll bleach mine. Mm-hmm. And then I grew it real long and suddenly I looked like probably what I always wanted to look like without even knowing.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah, I get it.
Yeah, and that's it. It's like, and my wife as well, you know, is of course a deep help with this because she goes, you know, she's like, look, when you leave the house, you know, just dress like, you know, dress like you, dress like the idea of you.
Mm.
So I just wear black all the time now and it works.
Mm.
But like people, like I can't, if I mean, you know, I'm not a famous person, but I can go to particular towns in the UK and in Australia. And if I stand around long enough, and this can be anywhere between half an hour to, you know, 4 days, people will, you know, I look like Darkroom. They're like, Darkroom, you know, and they know. It's like, hey, and that's a really nice thing. And that also, that ties back into a thing I learned at doing the anime conventions, right? Because that was the only time I had a sense of presentation. I don't understand why that was. But the thing is this, I used to always wear a purple jacket, right? No one else had a purple jacket.
Yeah.
And if you wear the same outfit every time, everyone knows where you are.
Mm.
That's useful. Yeah. Even if they don't know your name, they go, there's the guy in the purple jacket. There he is.
Yeah, it's something I've thought about a lot, especially with interviewing comedians that have a look.
Mm.
You know, like I was talking to Tate Face about this.
Oh, yeah.
And how, you know, if he doesn't wear the
mostly
stripy
silent
top,
interview, yeah.
he could just walk around. Yeah. It was a very long interview. But you know, he just played music. But with when he doesn't wear that jumper, he said, I can walk around, like I can walk up to people who've known me a while and it'll take them a second to go, sorry, Sam.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like because they're used to how he looks.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
One thing I found, because I thought at one point, pretty shortly after I got my hair bleached, right, I thought that it was the hair. So what would happen is I would leave venues. I'd never owned hoodies, but I bought some hoodies and I would put the hoodie on and leave the venue, right? Like, and this is after doing like a rough pub gig, just for fun, right? Nah.
Yeah.
Nah, it turns out people watch your face during the show.
Especially when you've got a torch on it.
Well, yeah. Well, people aren't stupid, you know. No. And also, I mean, I do hoodies after club gigs. When we do Dark Room, you know, I mean, I've probably... as a guy said to me once, he was like, when I met you, you were in black wearing a big jacket. Then you went on stage as Dark Room and you were in black and you had big shoulder pads on. Now you're back in a different big jacket and wearing black. Like, so it's like, oh, who's this guy? Yeah. You know, it's like if people coming to Dark Room, like I can show up and I've got a suitcase and I'm all in black leather. And people who don't even know the show just kind of go, oh, that'll be the guy.
Yeah.
Which is a nice feeling.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of people don't want to be typecast.
Hmm.
But I feel like there are advantages to it.
Well, I mean, typecast is an interesting thing because I thrive on my versatility. You know what I mean? Like there's typecast in the sense of, oh, there's John, he looks like John, right? But I've got a body of work.
Mm.
And that's, you know, that's its own reward because you have the people who are like, oh, we like John, the whip-wielding sadomasochist. We like John, the anarchist. We like John, the singer. We will hopefully enjoy John's book that's coming out. Mm. Some people like... You know, they like my little polemics that I'll write down on Facebook occasionally. So they like me as a columnist.
Mm.
You know what I mean? And like people don't come to me because what they want is mainstream stand up. They come to me because they want to laugh and they want to get it the way I want to give it to them.
Mm.
It's a nice feeling.
Yeah.
And I've got a whole bunch of different avenues by which I can do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah, I don't feel typecast in any way because I got all this shit going on.
Of course.
You know, and it doesn't bother me that most articles about me, if we're talking about comedy, start with John Robertson, probably best known for The Dark Room. It's like, well, why not?
Oh, no, this wasn't
No, I know, I'm just saying.
Negative. I'm saying there's a lot of people who think about that, you know, where they say, oh, I'm known for this thing, but I've got so much of it. You know, that, and I understand that, but it's also like, I feel like there's a worry that the thing they're best known for is holding them back in some ways.
Well, maybe it is. Maybe it is for them.
But it's still a live thing, I suppose, in like it's still existing, you're still doing it. I suppose if you'd stopped doing it 10 years ago, you might be like, well, why are people still bringing up that?
To be honest with you, I would be delighted. You know, because the thing is, I have people who remember my earlier work. I've been around long enough, and I've had people who have been kind enough to take a great interest in what I do, and they remember shit. You know, like the guy who said to me at one point, Bob the Blob and his vomiting knob, which turns out to be something I said in a show in 2009. And because I was like, is that one of mine? They're like, yeah, well, fuck, all right.
Yeah.
You know, people are very kind. And it's like people who remember, like if I put out the Australian Idol audition that I did and I put that out online, some people will go, oh, I remember that. And then they're like, is that you? Right. And it's nice because that's somebody who came to your career later and wasn't aware but remembers seeing that on TV.
Totally.
Yeah.
And I've heard The Dark Room being described as a cult hit a lot.
Well, it is.
And I suppose... Yeah. Well, this is the thing.
The Darrens.
There's a lot of people who... If it's a cult hit, surely it's a... It's not a mainstream hit, but it's a... It's a hit. Do you know what I mean? Like, what you automatically then you were like, oh, it is. Like, how do you view a cult hit then different to, say, just a hit?
Well, what I said was, because I said it is, and then I said the Darrens. Because, well, look, okay, the other day, and this, all right, this isn't a name drop because the circumstances by which it happened are silly, right? But Dara O'Brien, who's an excellent comic, as we know, Dara... came to see Dark Room.
I hope you appreciate how hard it was for me not to go. Sorry, Dara.
Yeah, I would have loved to have heard that.
After you said it was a name drop, every element of me wanted to go,
It was the 19th century absurdist movement came to see us. You know, they had a fish and God, they really didn't like whatever they didn't like. Yeah, whatever that was about. Anyway, he came along to see Dark Room and, well, you know, was very kind about it. That was nice of him. But I messaged him because the game's come out and I was just like, oh, hey, can I send you a copy? Right. So I sent him a copy and he ended up tweeting a lovely thing about the game because he went out on stage in Bristol and there was a woman in the front row wearing one of my shirts. Right. And that's what I mean when I say it's a cult hit, because he was like, hey, respect to the grassroots marketing or underground, you know, because that's what it is. You know, like I've got guys, they like to call themselves Darrens. There's the Darren Zord, who's like a group of elite Darrens who have formed one kind of massive Darren, like in the Power Rangers. And people who know all the catchphrases. And it's something, you know, it's something for them. And it's built up a beautiful community. Mm. And the reason that I say cult hit is because that's out of respect for them. That's out of respect for what they've built. Like the Darren's Flamboyant Potato Appreciation Society. You know, or the Black Balloon Brigade. These are all like groups of people who appreciate the work, enjoy it, and they bring new people to it, and they have fun, and you know, like they make the live show as glorious as it is. And so it's things like when I go to new territories, even though we have a really nice time, I miss those guys. Mm. You know, there's something wonderful about seeing people who are genuinely, like, the show is a man in leather abusing you, and they're there to support that, and they're into it. You know what I mean? Yeah. And it's that thing, like, we did the Insomnia Gaming Festival the other day, and there were some cosplayers there, and one bloke leant over and was like, he is going to fuck you up. And then, of course, I did.
Yeah.
You know, I showed up. They were like halfway down the room. You know, there were 1,500 people there. They were like somewhere in row 10, right? And I went down and fucking ripped them. And he was like, we told you. And I was like, you know, how wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, like a guy in the middle of the room is like, I've seen him so often. I know he will spot you, particularly you, and he's coming. And it's, yeah, and that's great. Mm. And that's why it's a cult hit, because the people who are fucking into it really make it. You know? And that's what I want.
Yeah, totally. I feel like a lot of people would like their just base to come back. But I know, I mean, when I was in Edinburgh this year, you had like a really big poster on the Cowgate of your face and stuff. And so I suppose as much as you want to respect the cult, you do want to bring in new people.
Well, of course. But the thing is, the cult bring in new people too. And I mean, let's not call them the supporters bring in. Yeah.
That was my fault.
I mean, to be honest, if it was a cult, we'd be one step closer to what I actually want, which is a religion, because of course it's tax-free. But
So are posters and things bringing in people as well?
Yeah. Do you know? Of course. Like, yeah, they do. I mean, just like, because it's spectacle. Mm. And that's, you know, and that's fine. We, like, new people, of course, are what we want. Mm. Okay. But the core are really beautiful. And the thing is, I like to go and do shows that are just for them. Mm. Like we had in Leeds. Was it Leeds? Leeds. The Wardrobe. Leeds. Yeah. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, we had an event. I didn't organise it. They did. Darren Con won. You know? And that was members of Darren's Flamboyant Potato Appreciation Society, guys from the Sci-Fi Weekender. And that room was sold out, you know? Like it was mostly people. And they had spent all day together, you know, making flamboyant potato shit. That's what we call a pineapple. Yeah. I should give some context to that, right? And there's a lovely person there who'd made a darkroom plushie, you know, and had even put in the detail of my teeth and the armour lit up, right? And all of that's gorgeous. And so the thing that I really like is when you go to see, it's like when you go to the wrestling, okay, which I really admire. When you go to see a live wrestling show and the crowd are super into it and the crowd are chanting along because they got there before you did, right? You will join in and it becomes a wonderful thing.
Definitely.
Right? And that's the phase that we're in at the moment where it's like, all right, you know, we throw the doors open to whoever's interested. Come for whatever reason, whether it's like, I like to see people get verbally fucked up. Come on in. A game show? Great. A retro gaming thing? Great. Oh, he's just a good comic and I was looking for something to watch? Great. We welcome everybody. You know, whatever. Come in, right? But if you're there and it's like, hang on a minute, that half of the crowd are chanting along. What is this? I think that's more magical, you know, and so that's what I'm saying. You know, of course we'll bring in, you know, we'll always go seeking new audiences.
Yeah.
But for me, a huge part of the spectacle is the crowd that's really adopted it.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
Yeah.
And now you do a kids version.
Yeah, it's the same show.
It's the same show.
It's the same show.
And how do they get involved differently?
Well, kids.
Or is it you're picking the parents to do the?
No, I pick the kids.
Okay.
The thing with kids is...
Do you ignore the parents? So I don't mean to interrupt you.
No. I sometimes attack the parents. I attack whoever feels right.
I assume you have to be slightly more PC with how you attack a child.
Well, we don't... Well, the thing is...
You're talking like silly.
Well, look, PC is an odd thing because I always like... And again, to make a wrestling, you know, make a wrestling metaphor here, right... Because I briefly trained as a pro wrestler. What you do to wrestle is you hit somebody as hard as you can in a safe place. You know, so like you might hit somebody with your forearm, not the hardest part of your arm, and you might hit them across the back of their shoulders and it makes a tremendous noise and they can feel a wampum impact, but it's not going to hurt them. Mm. You know what I mean? And the thing is, when I attack people, right, it's a lot like that as well. Like, I mean, you can say to somebody, look, you friendless loser, right? And be right and have them love it because they're like, I am a friendless loser. That's tremendous. How did you know? Right? But yeah, with kids, right, I wouldn't want to go after anything that was a weakness anyway. Mm. You know what I mean? I mean, the only thing that you do is you go after things that are irritating the rest of the audience, but you have to make certain that you know exactly what it is that's doing it. And mostly what it is genuinely talkative, talkative, overindulged young white boys, you know, very much, you know, kids who are pretty much mirror images of me at that age, trying to make the show about them. And you can wheel around and just go, shut the fuck up. And people will lose their minds, like depending on the mood, right? Usually, you know, like in the kids show, probably, you know, about as strong as the swearing will get is shit. And I'm much more likely to threaten, you know, real violence. Whereas in the adult show, when we have children, one of the first things that I'll do is go, are there any children here? We get a kid, like, how old are you? Oh, I'm 6. This has happened, by the way. I'm 6. You don't mind if I swear at you, do you, sweetheart? No? Good, I'm going to break your teeth, you little fuckhead. Right? People, they just lose their minds. They clap, they have a great time. Mm. You know, it's just spectacle.
What made you want to go to do a kids show then?
Oh, money. I was promised. I was promised money. Right. But it was one of those things where, like, that was my producers who thought it would be a really good idea.
Catface.
Yeah, Catface. Yeah. But then it turned out to be a really good idea because, like, it's a different. The different experience is that adults respond faster than children. Adults respond faster correctly. Right? Children require a little bit of a thing, but what you have to do with the kids is you have to go them hard, and because it doesn't matter that they don't know what an old video game is, that doesn't mean shit, right? It's just the yelling man is here, he looks funny, the rules are you pick this, and if you fail, you die. Mm. And you get that across with the children, and Bob's your uncle, you're away to the races, you can do whatever you want, you know, give the kids a crap prize, brilliant, they love that, okay? They get that down entirely. But despite the fact I used to be a kids entertainer, I'd forgotten so much about doing it by the time we actually got round to it that I was initially quite afraid of bothering the children. So the first fringe run we did of it, the shows that were really good are the ones where I did not give a fuck. Mm. And I have to remember that at all times, just not to care and be brutal. It's my birthday. I couldn't care less. You know, you'll never see another one. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. That's it. Someone tear the throat out of that one. You, the ugly boy. You know, how will I know he's ugly? He's in a darker... Actually, I'd probably do that to a father. Mm. You, ugly. You know, because that's a thing as well. You know, like what adults can take in front of children is a wonderful thing. you know, oh, that's it. And also, yeah, we get a lot of mileage at these shows just turning to fathers being like, how's the divorce going? They fucking hate that, but the room loves it. Mm. Yeah, look at this sea of Prosecco mums, that kind of thing. Anyway, so I was told, you know, like that this would be a good little bit of extra scratch. And that's how it began. But then, you know, you're just playing with children. Mm. So you're back to really what you'd started doing, you know, what would have gotten you into it anyway, which is a lovely thing, and you're being paid for it. And, I was going to throw the kids' show in the bin when we turned up to Leicester Comedy Festival because the adult show was oversold and the kids' show was only half. And I was like, maybe it's not working. And then we won Best Kids Show. Mm. So I was like, oh, okay.
Did that help? Did that help with ticket sales for Edinburgh? Or does that award not transfer?
No, it helped. Okay. I mean, like, the kids' show was really healthy. Like, the thing that helps the kids' show is just me remembering to be myself and attack with the violence and, you know, the violence and the gore and the emotional range. But occasionally with kids, you just take it down a little bit. You know, hello, right? They don't, you know, don't patronize them. No. That's the most important thing, is not to patronize them. And the worst days are the days when you find yourself doing that because you're worried that a parent won't like it.
I went and saw, this year I actually saw the most kids shows I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Just because, A, I enjoy watching friends of mine who do, like I see all year round, have to tackle kids. And B, not tackle is the wrong word, but they, depends on the show.
Yeah.
But also the way that you have to articulate an idea to a kid without being patronizing is always, it's just a really good lesson in sort of communicating a point to someone in a way that, like you said, they'll take a little longer.
Yeah,
but they don't need to be told. You know, like there's no barrier there as such, other than just timing, because they haven't had enough life experience to know some of the rules of the game of a theatre, if you like.
Yeah, that's it. You just give them the important bits,
yeah,
and just make it clear and make it fun.
Yeah,
and that's what we strive to do. You know, like, to be honest, the best thing that happened this year with Dark Room for Kids is that a man who had stepped on a landmine whilst fighting in Afghanistan came to the show and he shook me by the hand and told me how much his son had enjoyed it. And he just went, that is really good family friendly entertainment. Because, I mean, you're looking at a guy who's gone to extremes of humanity that other people can't, you know, and if they're very lucky in the rest of their lives, won't ever have to, you know, like he's literally been in the shit, you know. And if that guy can turn around and go, all right, no, that's good, That's good. That thing you're doing there, that's good. That, you know, that's really meaningful. Because that puts things in perspective. Because you might go, oh, I don't know, is that too much for the kids? Mm. It's like, well, this is a guy who, because I mean, thing is, right, you don't come away from a landmine unmaimed.
No.
You know, and this is a guy whose, you know, child has had to live through the trauma of him coming back and all of this. And when you see that and they come to you, you're just like, yeah, I reckon I probably will say fuck. You know, I don't think it means anything.
No, it's just language.
It is just language. Well, I mean, you know, there's that whole
hierarchy of language.
Well, without getting the whole thin end of the wedge. Oh, they're just words, mate. They're just words. Yeah, no, that didn't work for bullies when I was at school, as I remember.
No, I don't want to get into that again because I talk about it a lot on the podcast.
Well, I bet you are.
If it's an excuse,
I don't want to get into it.
Then it's
I don't want to get into it at all. Okay. I mean, for me, like that entire argument fell down when I was 9 because it's like, well, you're saying deliberately the thing that you know will hurt me.
Yeah.
So now I'm going to hurt you.
But no, that's what I mean. It's the intention of the word. So if I just say "fuck you," like now, you know that there's no like actual intention for me to say "get this," you know, like it's
exactly.
It's, yeah.
And the thing is, as well, if Darkroom, the character,
yeah,
fuck you.
Yeah.
So it's just like the very idea.
Yeah.
You know, the video game doesn't like me.
Yeah. Exactly. And it contextually. You could almost say anything as long as they're on your side. You could do the biggest threat ever and it would be fine. Why have you made it a game? What was the... It's kind of come full circle now. What was... How long has that been a project and what was the reasoning behind making it an actual game?
Well, we'd always wanted to make an actual game.
Right.
But, just for various reasons, it wasn't appropriate. You know, there was we were thinking about it last year, maybe making it a mobile game, which would have been a very different model. And then Stirfire Studios in Perth, who a mob that's principally made up of people I've known since I was 15, they're very talented and they were looking for an interesting project involving mocap. And of course, what could possibly involve more motion capture than something based entirely on a live performance? So that coalesced quite nicely and it became... Like it became a really good opportunity as much as I can offer, give back to my own community, you know, give back to the great geek culture of Perth, Western Australia, which, you know, has supported me, Jesus, you know, from before I was in stand-up, bloody supported me for 18 years, right? And, you know, and that those guys would really help me by finally making, a document that would just, you know, like, it just works for you while you sleep. And even though I'm spending a lot of my time at the moment promoting the game, you know, you wake up in the morning, you check those sales figures, you're like, great, look at that. You know, like people, who knows where these people are from? Who knows who they are? You know, are picking it up and it's, you know, people are buying it at a steady rate and all of that. And... Yeah, I mean, we made it because that was something we'd always wanted to do. The opportunity presented itself. And then in order to do that, it became again, you know, great, you got a deadline, there's a paycheck at the end of this, burst, you know, and 100 pages, which eventually turned out to be 3.5 hours of recorded footage later, recorded in a marathon week session. You know, a session of mocap that was so physically draining that it gave me a hernia, like literally a section of my stomach wall popped through, you know, which I kept secret because that happened about day 4 of filming and we had another 2 days. So I just didn't let them know that I was in a lot of pain and it was hurting to shout. You know, drank a lot of whiskey. And we put this thing together. I mean, level 1 is out. It's got an hour of motion captured footage in it. And now another 2 levels are going to drop, you know, as we move out of Steam Early Access. And it's just fascinating.
So it's in many ways kind of a love letter to your supporters.
Yeah, very much. Like we deliberately created it so that, because I mean, a big concern, the studio had, 3 concerns. One was that I had never done a game before, but then we were able to allay them by pointing them. One to the success of the live show, you know, and the YouTube, both versions of the YouTube game, and without mentioning White Room even once, you know, and they were able to look at that and go, okay, no, those really do function as games, you know, and they are good, right? And I think they just want to know what I intended, you know, whether or not like it was just going to be like, yeah, this game's just going to deliberately irritate you. It's like, no. The game will irritate you if you play badly. That's the convention we've gotten rid of. Like, a lot of games encourage you, like, you know, the level's designed so you're going to go over here and you're going to see this. And this isn't like that, right? The game is designed, if you're going in the wrong way, to discourage you. And it's up to you to find the right way, right? It's like a kid said to me, kid's watching the live show and goes, you just die. You just die. Like, for everything. You just die for everything. And I was like, well, no, you don't, because there are good options. And she's like, well, what's a good option? I went, well, one where you don't die. And she was like, oh. And then I'm like, yeah, it takes 20 correct steps to leave the dark room. And she's like, what? And that was the thing. I was like, because then she's like, hang on, so there's 20 steps where you don't die. And I'm like, yeah, but they're not the only 20.
That's what annoyed me most when I came and saw it.
Yeah.
Was someone kept picking something like turn the light switch on. And I was like, have you not worked out that that is not a fucking good option?
Yeah.
Like, it was literally, I was yelling at the other side of the room going, you fucking moron.
Yeah, that's like, what it's for.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's the thing, you know. So their initial concern was that, but of course that feeds into it. That feeds into people's experience of it, because it's like an 80s text adventure, which is you just go, it's like, you're just going to keep doing the same thing? Has anything changed contextually?
Yeah.
You know, but also in this, there's room to be open to that, because maybe if you do something 100 times, something will change, or maybe it won't. It's like life, for fuck's sake.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's the whole banging your head against the wall thing. Eventually something might give way, you or the wall, or nothing will happen depending on how strong you're doing it, etc. So that was their first concern. Then there was concerns about the content of it, because they knew that I would be brutal and that the game would have a lot, you know, more scope for brutality. And it does, you know, like I've used it as an excuse to target American gun crime and gun culture, and the incels get whacked and all this stuff is just in there. You know, there's a moment where this animal speaks to you in a Son of Sam-esque manner and delivers a whole bunch of life advice that is not to be followed through on, you know, and it's brutal and morbid and all this shit. And because it's being presented verbally, like, when people write about it, they're like, I did this and I did this and I did this. And they're coming out of the game going, I did this, all this stuff. When, of course, like, well, did you really do that? Yeah, it feels like you did. That's brilliant. You know, when I've just spent 38 hours in a game where I'm like, and we drove in the buggy and we went over there, we went through the desert and we rescued this man. All right, you play this game because stuff's hard to unlock. Yeah. When stuff happens, like, you do feel a sense of triumph.
Yeah.
So that's something I wanted to give people, you know. And then, what was the other thing? Yeah, the content, the fact I'd never made a game before. And yeah, maybe they ended up being a little worried about how much stuff was going to go in there. But it's, yeah, it's interesting. And it's just like, to produce, okay, to go from a show that was a parody of how shit old games were to now being a show that is in its own right a good game. And part of the reason some people keep coming back is because they're finding the hidden story that's in there. And now to have that existing and, like, approaching not its final form, but its final iteration for that medium, you know, first and final, you know, what a lovely feeling, you know, like, it's as close as I've ever felt to feeling like Douglas Adams. Because, of course, there's no, depending on the version, from the radio play to the TV show to the novels, and the movie, huge elements of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy change. So it's different variations of the same, you know, same franchise.
And I'm feeling that as you're talking about different models as we're talking through it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's it. You know, like, the live show doesn't have the same map as the YouTube game. It doesn't even have the same story as the original YouTube game. And this thing has a different story to the live show. And, well, you know, not that different, but it's expanded and the map's completely different. And yeah, it's just, whoo. You know, fuck. I mean, it's it's an incredibly lovely creative endeavor. Yeah. And once we make that budget back, commercial.
I've got two more questions for you, but I'm going to ask one and see if it's worth being the final one, just based on your answer.
Okay? Sure, man.
What's the biggest mistake you've made and how did you overcome it?
Well, professionally?
Yeah.
Well, okay. The biggest mistake I made was letting stress in. That was the... And because that dogged me. That dogged me for longer than that first 5 years. It was a real enemy for the first 5 years, but it filtered into every interaction. And it meant that... Like, there's a lot of stuff especially in my early career, that would have been better if I just kind of nodded occasionally and went like, yeah, you know, and didn't presume malice where malice was not present. But on the flip side, because I believed I was involved in this sort of sacred, holy quest towards whatever, you know, it motivated me to get off the couch. It's that thing of just like, don't worry about not having the thing today. Things will happen, and just be, you know, like. At the moment, I'm in a position where I can quite pleasantly look back and I go, wow, that's a lot of work and it hasn't really hurt to do, you know, whereas when I was younger, everything, getting anything out of me was like pulling teeth. And I realized at one point that I had the ego of a very successful, genius artist with none of the accomplishment behind it. And so it's not about... Yeah, it's about, you got to filter your aggression to where it's meant to go. That for me would be the biggest mistake that I made in my career. But I mean, again, and you know, this will sound like, you know, somebody, it's like, this is the biggest mistake. It's not a great tragedy. But it's that thing of like, just take shit when it's necessary, but don't fall in to being one of those people who just constantly take shit. Or for me, the difference is this. And this is specifically in the context of live club stand-up, right? And we're talking about the hand-to-mouth you booker relationship. There's a club in Sydney. First time I rang them up, they went, oh, John Robertson. Oh, we know you. Great, come headline the club, right? Because I'd been going to Sydney and getting paid work. Because I was going in getting paid work, because I, you know, rung some of the correct people and other people had vouched for me, I had value, right? And I had value long enough that this one place could go, how great. There was a very talented comedian from Perth. He showed up. One night I was going there, down there to headline, and I was like, wow, you're here. You're in Sydney. What are you doing? He goes, oh, yeah, I've flown over. I've flown over and I'm doing 10-minute spots all around the place. And I went, that's great, man. And then I'm like, hang on, what? What do you mean? You're doing 10 minutes tonight. And he goes, yeah. And I'm like, you're getting paid? No. And I was just like, shit, you know. He's, while in the long term, that will endear him, you know, to some people. And maybe he'll, you know, be pulled through the ranks and that'll help him, right? For me, I was like, but this is a club that I know you can just walk straight through the door in. And I knew that guy's body of work. And I knew he could have done it. But he didn't present himself as having any value. So, of course, they just went, oh, great, another guy. More grist to the mill. You know, we got a lot of comics. You know, great, you'll just be happy because you got the time. And yeah, I don't like that. You know, because he could quite easily have been headlining that show. But I was. You know?
Yeah.
That kind of thing. And the difference was I had gone in, done the work, and shown I had value because I refused, you know, unless it was totally necessary, I refused to eat shit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? So that helped.
Yeah.
That helped. But I just wish occasionally when I was younger, the word cunt wasn't appended to the conversation. Like, no, I won't fucking come. It was, you know, totally unnecessary. And of course, I didn't have, my voice wasn't as deep at the time. So it was very, very pissy and very prissy histrionics.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to leave it there, but thank you very much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you. It's a pleasure. Where's the money?
That was John. Hearing about how he moved the idea from different mediums and how he's never forgot those people who supported him along the way was inspiring and amazing to hear. I'm one of these people that literally I spend the 4-hour journey home from Edinburgh emailing and messaging everyone who's contributed, even in the smallest sense, to my Edinburgh Festival to say thank you, because I feel like everyone deserves the praise they have for helping support me. And I do that for gigs. I stand at the door, I say hi to everyone on the way in, and I thank them on the way out, and I send them an email if they sign up to the mailing list. And I loved hearing someone who is further down the line to this to me who hasn't forgotten that. And even though there are other people who are big names who haven't forgotten that, I just don't feel like that it's talked about enough, that there are people that make your career and there are people that support you early on that you need to remember, and you need to really give back to those people as best you can.
I loved hearing about how he's happy with his cult following and his cult status, if you like, being known for the dark room. It was great to hear a plus side of being typecast in a very specific way. I feel like a lot of people try to avoid being typecast, and so I don't know, it's nice to hear an alternative view to typecasting that's a positive one. If you want to get a copy of the game, there's going to be a link in the description. Please do go and buy it. You can find it in the show notes, or you can just search for The Dark Room anywhere on the internet, and I'm sure you'll find it. If you like this episode, you might also like the episode I did with Rob Kemp about his high-concept comedy musical hybrid show, God, that's a mouthful, called The Elvis Dead. Or you might like my episode with Richard Herring about how he takes his ideas and puts them in different formats online, gives them away for free, and then asks the audience to support him so that he can continue creating things that they value. I really think you'll get a lot out of both those episodes if you like this one. So do go and scroll back and please check them out. The Ask the Industry podcast is a Fruit That Got in Gravity's Way production for the internet. All elements were created by me, comedian Simon Kane. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for subscribing. And thank you very much for rating and donating if you do. I'll see you all in about 14 days' time. Before you go, I just want to quickly say I'm going to be at the Edinburgh Festival. I'm drilling down the details on dates, times, and all that sort of stuff. But just so you're aware, I'm going to be at the Edinburgh Festival in 2019. I'm also going to be previewing the show from about April onwards around the country, and then I'm going to be on tour in September and October. Now, this is the most vague plug I've done for anything, but essentially I'm going to be updating my website with these details as soon as they are available. Please do keep an eye out for them. I'd really appreciate it, as that would really help. The one thing I can confirm is I am doing a one-off, potentially DVD record. Again, that is something I'm dealing with. I'm sorting it out. Of Sex, Drugs and Other Things I Never Do at the Bloomsbury Theatre in London on the 21st of March 2019. If you can come to that, please do. If you would like to get half off the tickets, tweet me something mysterious like my favourite macaroon is strawberry flavoured, right? Tweet me that and I would DM you the discount code so you can get money off your tickets to come and see that show live. I'd really love to get some of your listeners in and to watch the show. I'm really, really excited about it, but also really nervous about it, as it's quite a big space, even though it's the studio space. But yeah, I want to get the thing recorded and out the door. So if you can come, please do. If you can't come, please tell a friend and hopefully they'll come. Thanks for listening.
You die, you die, you die, you die.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.